Welcome back to the BVA Boardroom Podcast. We have a very special guest today. Brian Scott from AllScott Inc., chairman and co-executive chairman of AllScott Inc. Brian's a good friend of mine, and I'm going to give a little bit of his bio here. So he's an aviation enthusiast, flies airplanes and helicopters. He is the great-grandson of Joe and Catherine Albertson and one of the founders of the Albertsons enterprise. We'll talk a little bit about it, but a huge community advocate here in Idaho in the Treasure Valley. His father, Joe Scott, I want to talk a little bit about him, your family owned Shore Lodge and White Tail Club Resorts in McCall. Little known fact, I think, from people that are really just getting to know you from the business world, former professional stock car racer and was the first Idaho native to make a debut at the Daytona 500.
Yeah, it's... I think you did a good job at capping everything off. But yeah, you know, from 2006 until 2017, I'd lived in North Carolina and I kind of pursued a race car driving career, which was fun. I did that in lieu of going to college. But I think it was the best education I could have got. I got to be surrounded by a lot of very successful and great leaders. I got to drive for Joe Gibbs, got to drive for Richard Childress, got to drive for Richard Petty, and just got to be around a lot of really smart people and really motivational people. And I always say I went to college for 11 years, got married, had kids, and traveling, you know, 10 months out of the year every weekend, kind of lost its appeal and moved back to Idaho to join the family business.
I want to hear a little bit more about this because I've heard some of the stories, but it is big business, right? Big business. And you just mentioned some of the biggest names in the industry, right? Tell us a little bit about the teamwork, the business behind racing, the travel, those teams. I mean, I think for many of us that are maybe kind of casual fans, having gone to some NASCAR races, it's mind-boggling to be down there in the pits and just see what goes on. But tell us a little bit on the inside what that world's like.
Yeah, I'll try to explain the business of NASCAR as quickly as I can. So you have the teams, and the teams are they're the ones that own the numbers and own the cars, and then they hire the drivers and the crew chiefs and everything like that. So in NASCAR, there's a couple of big name teams. There's the Hendrick Motorsports, the Richard Childress, the Joe Gibbs, the Penske, and each of those teams, and there's more teams and everything like that, but each of those teams might have three teams underneath it. So they got one big team, and then underneath it, you'll have a couple different teams. And each team is a number. That's the number that you race on the track. So say Hendrick Motorsports, for example, they have four teams. They have the number five car that currently is driven by Kyle Larson. They have the 24 car that's driven by William Byron. They have the 9 car that's driven by Chase Elliott. And so each of those are like a sub team under the big team. So the big team tries to get the teams to work together, but ultimately on the racetrack, each team is trying to get the best finish that they can. There have been instances in NASCAR where one team was maybe running for the championship and the other wasn't, and the team that wasn't tried to do something to impact the race, and NASCAR said, we don't want that, and they kind of came down heavy-handed. And then each of those teams have a sponsor, or they'll have multiple sponsors, and it's kind of the main team, so it's like Hendrick's deal is to try to get sponsorship money for each of those teams underneath it. And then they typically, the business of racing in the Cup Series, to run the year, it's going to be $20-ish million. So there used to be sponsors that would cover the whole thing. Now you see guys that have come in that will have 5 races, and then another company will have 5 races. So the main team gets the sponsorship. They hire the driver. They hire the crew chiefs. Sometimes drivers come with sponsorship and say, hey, look, I want to drive for you, and I've got a company that loves me that's willing to put in $10 million, so I'll come in. You know, you try to fill out the second half of it, and you can kind of work your way into teams that way, or you're just a really good, successful race car driver, and the team's like, you know what, you might not have any sponsorship money with you, but I'm gonna I'm going to get the sponsorship for the car, and then I'm just going to put the best driver that I can in it.
Huge business. Tell me about the Michael Jordan team, because only I'll tell you, it's the last NASCAR race I went to, we got down in the pits, and as I went around, his branding's really cool. And as how long has he been in it, and why, and has he just been an enthusiast? Or
so he's been involved in the sport for a while. He first got involved with a driver named Denny Hamlin. Yeah. Denny Hamlin brought the Air Jordan brand on. He started wearing a fire suit that had the Air Jordan brand, started doing some stuff with him, and Michael Jordan started coming around the racetrack to watch Denny and to support Denny because they're friends. They play golf together and have they know each other. And then Denny decided that he drives for Joe Gibbs Racing, but he decided he wanted to also start and own his own team, and he partnered with Michael Jordan. So they call it 2311. So 23 for Jordan, and Denny Hamlin's number in racing is 11. So they call it 2311 Racing, and now they're a two-car team. And they've been a team for 2 or 3 years, I think.
That's cool. Tell us about the physical requirements of being a driver, because the training that goes into it, I think people don't realize just how physical the sport is.
Yeah, it's interesting now that, you know, with technology coming along and how much more we can measure biometrics and things with drivers. And so we're seeing, you know, a NASCAR race is 3 hours, I think, is about the average. And we have some that are five. Like the Coca-Cola 600 at Charlotte Motor Speedway is the longest race we have. It's five-ish hours. And inside the car, we're in full Nomex fire suits, multiple layers. The car is obviously, it's an advantage to be as light as possible. So there's not a lot of creature comforts inside the car. And we're sitting on top of the exhaust and right behind the engine. And
is it hot?
Oh, so the average temperature throughout a race, I mean, it can fluctuate depending on where you are, but it seems like it's always around about 150 degrees. Maybe it can go up to 160 degrees. So you're in 150, 160 degree temperature for 3 to 5 hours. And then the amount of G forces that you sustain are different. So you're either experiencing a lot of lateral G's on the flat bank tracks, or you're experiencing a lot of vertical G's on the higher bank tracks, where you get more of that like G force, like a fighter pilot when you go into the corner, cause you're going 200 miles an hour into banking. And then you get that vertical G effect, or you get a lot of lateral G because you're going through the corner at 160 miles an hour. And there's no banking, so it's like everything's trying to throw you over to the right side of the car.
Were you an adrenaline junkie growing up? Is that?
Oh yeah, I mean that's what led me to racing. Was I wanted to ride motorcycles and I wanted to have go-karts and I wanted to do this, and I was kind of an adrenaline junkie and a little bit wild. Where I think my dad and parents tried to figure out, well, what's an organized fashion that he could do this in, so he's not just tearing up the neighbors' yards and we're getting calls from all of our neighbors type of thing.
What was the scariest incident you had while racing?
Scary, you know, so I was really fortunate. I never caught on fire and I never flipped in a stock car. I broke my wrist in a wreck at Michigan. It wasn't like it hurt, and it wasn't like a hard looking hit. It was kind of one of those hits that looked like the one that killed Dale Earnhardt. I mean, it just kind of went in. People would have thought he was fine, but you just kind of hit at the wrong angle and my hand got caught up in the steering wheel and it broke my wrist. But that wasn't a scary one. I did have a wreck at Talladega where they call it the big one, where you, in restrictor plate racing at tracks like Talladega and Daytona, you'll see it, the whole pack is together and we're like three wide bumper to bumper. And when something happens in front of you, it collects a lot of cars because everybody's just all together and we're going 200 and something miles an hour. And one of those events happened in front. It was mass chaos. I thought I was missing it, but one of the cars that got hit in front of me spun around backwards, flipped up in the air, and it was right in front of me. I almost like drove under it as he was up in the air. And I guess I don't know if that was scary. I don't know if it was scary, but it was intense. Maybe the most intense crash that I had.
You're built different, Brian.
You're in the moment, right? So everybody is like, man, I'd be scared to death if I got in a car and went 200 miles an hour. But it's different when you're in a car that's built for it. You're going around other drivers that are going 200 miles an hour, and you're in a track that's designed for it too. So, I mean, it doesn't feel like you're going 200 miles an hour when you're out there, really.
Do you miss it?
I miss the competitive part of it. You know, that's the hardest thing to fill when you are a professional athlete and you do something at a highly competitive level. and then you retire. You know, what do you do to fuel that competitiveness and, you know, thrill seeking that you got that was a big part of your life for so long?
So probably a corny question, but I'm going to ask it anyway, because I think there probably are, I think people that are professional athletes like you.
Used to be, ex.
There are so many lessons you learn for life, leadership, teamwork, competitiveness, how to channel that energy. What have you seen that's been the most effective? Because now we'll talk, we'll get into business world, the world you're in now. And I call you one of the young guns in Idaho, right? The young leaders of these, of companies now here. What did you take from that professional driving into your life now that would be a benefit to people listening?
Well, like you said, you know, you learn teamwork, you learn hard work. You know, the thing in professional sports and racing especially is the highs are really high and the lows are really low. And when you do that for so long, you learn to not take the highs for granted, and you learn how to try to pick yourself and your team up out of a low. So I think for me, how I apply it in the business world is when things aren't going my way, when it seems like the deck is stacked against me, you know, I kind of look at it as like, hey, I just had a bad race. You know, what am I going to do? And you just kind of got to button down the hatches, and you got to push forward and just, you know, push really hard to get out of that space and find solutions.
That's awesome. I've found people like you and people that, because think about the business world is high, very, very, very great highs, great days, and then lows. And those lows come in various ways, personnel issues, challenges, stuff you don't control, and you got to get your way through it. But I do find it interesting listening to you that it is immediately in a low about what's my way out? How am I going to rally others? It's not poor me. It's not, hey, why did this happen to me? It's, hey, it happened to me. Now, how am I going to get through that? And I just heard that when you said that, and I thought, I'm not surprised. Let's talk a little bit about Allscott. So you guys are commercial developers and have a lot of projects that you do around town. I've been able to work with you a couple times. You have a great team. Talk about that team and talk about the joys of coming into the business world. How's that been?
So I would say you're a commercial developer. We dabble in it. You know, we're lucky to be very divested and have a lot of different investments, and we're not trying to make our livelihood in commercial development, thank God. But we find pet projects and we try to do things that enhance Idaho. You know, we're very Idaho focused and Idaho based. So when we have something that is a passion project for somebody in the family, or it's a piece of dirt that we've drove by for our entire lives, and we're like, man, you know, this would be really perfect to go right here. You know, then we tend to go into it. We try to work up a pro forma and see how it works. But, you know, really we're a traditional family office. You know, we're invested in the market and, you know, money managers. We do some commercial development. We obviously have Shore Lodge Whitetail. So we've got a lot of real estate holdings. You know, real estates are a big part of our investment. Some of that is commercial development. Some of that is the club, Shore Lodge Whitetail being our largest real estate holding or investment, as you want to call it. But it's really, you know, Shore Lodge came to us because that was a passion project for my dad. We've got a residential development going on in Eagle because that was a passion project for me. We've got some land out in Parma because that was a passion project for my sister. So we're very lucky to have a family that works close together between my dad, my sister, and I. And we really support each other. If somebody wants to go out and try something or pursue something, then we figure out how to make it work and how to pencil it.
I love it. Let's talk about your dad. So I got to start. So I don't know that we've ever talked about this. Your dad certainly knows this. But when I first got to town here a long, long time ago now, and I was an ER doctor, I worked all night shifts. And for whatever reason, I took care of your great-grandmother many times. It was towards the years of her life where she was having some medical issues, and it seems like she always came in the middle of the night, so I always took care of her. She was just an angel of a woman. I remember those interactions like they were yesterday, and then her doctor was a legendary cardiologist. J.W. Smith was his name. But I used to call him, and he would be to the hospital like within 3 minutes to take care of her. And then together we'd go in and take care of her. But what a wonderful legacy. And you think about Idaho, you think about an Idaho built company with your great grandfather and your great grandmother. And now I see those qualities in your dad. Your dad's kind of a behind the scenes guy, kind of like the Wizard of Oz a little bit, right? And I consider it one of my most cherished friendships because I learned so much from him. He is as steady and as sound-minded in the way he looks at life, the way he looks at business dealings, the way he looks at the community. And I want to get into that a little bit with what you guys just had a ribbon cutting on. But talk a little bit about your dad and your legacy with your family.
So I think that everybody sees a lot of parallels between my dad and my great-grandparents, his grandparents, Joe and Catherine. You know, when my dad was growing up, his dad was really at the height of trying to make his career. He was in Albertsons, and then he went on to be the CEO of that, and then A&P. But his dad was working nonstop. In that era, you know, the culture, these people lived at the office. They worked 100 hours a week, and they were traveling, and they were opening stores, so he was always gone. So in large part, my dad would say that his grandparents, Joe and Catherine, really raised him. So I think you see a lot of that influence, you know, leak into him, a lot of the same qualities. And one of the things that I respect most about my dad is he does try to keep a low profile. He tries to fly under the radar. He doesn't want his name or, you know, he wants to do things and not even get credit for it. And I really respect that because, you know, a lot of people, they want to do things and they're like, I want my name on this. I want my name on this. And I want people to know that I did this and I did this and I did this. And he's done so much that people have no clue about just because he doesn't want to take any credit for it. He wants to help people and do things for the community and for Idaho and then just, you know, pat himself on the back and not have a big party to celebrate himself.
He's an incredible guy. I mean, the more you know of him and what motivates and drives him, I'll tell you, he is very, very passionate about people, about taking care of people in Idaho. And I think that, again, comes from your great-grandparents. But then when he gets an idea, let's talk about Mission 43. Right, I've heard the story from Roger, but your dad sticks his head in his office and said, "Hey, I want to do more for vets. I want to be there for them." And look at what's come from Mission 43. Talk a little bit about that. And I know we got a lot to talk about, but I do want to talk about what's happening in Southeast Boise right now that many people may not even realize because you guys do fly under the radar. And I appreciate that about you, but also, dang it, like this is such a community treasure for us. I want people to know what happens at Mission 43.
So I'll try to kind of address it in the order that you brought it up. So our family foundation, the Joe and Catherine Albertson Family Foundation, we really pushed hard to improve education in Idaho for a long time. And we were not getting many wins. We were never feeling good about what we were doing. It felt like we were continually making no progress despite all of our best efforts. We were trying to change a very bureaucratic system. You know, public education is tough to change and it doesn't want to change. And we were getting so frustrated, and I think my dad was getting so frustrated that he was really, I think he was yearning to feel good about something. You know, he wanted the foundation to do something that made him feel good about it because education wasn't doing it. And so he's had a big heart for veterans, especially post 9/11. And then these veterans are coming back. And I mean, it was every other day you were seeing a story in the newspaper about suicide and, you know, limbs being blown off and, you know, what the community was struggling and he wanted to figure out how to help it. So that kind of got the ball rolling within our foundation to try to figure out how can we help veterans. That's when we started Mission 43. We found Brian Madden, who started that initiative for us, and it kind of started really small and helping a few vets. Now it's grown into a whole statewide veteran community, and also veteran community. It helps veterans, you know, use their GI Bill to get education. It helps them write resumes. It helps them get jobs. It helps veterans' wives and veterans and first responders. You know, and it gives them a sense of community here in Idaho and a sense of teamwork and everything that they can work towards. From that, we also started finding parallels with adaptive athletes. So there's a large portion of the veteran community are adaptive because of their time in service. And then Idaho has a really high adaptive population, people that have some type of physical challenge. And we wanted to start helping those people. And so we started, we found somebody that was doing it nationwide named Challenged Athletes Foundation. And we started talking with them. We said, hey, what would it take to bring you guys to Idaho and to try to have like an Idaho CAF, you know, chapter? And they were just as excited to work with us and try to, you know, do grants to get adaptive equipment to athletes here in Idaho. And we brought them in and we started just, there was just such a natural synergy between Mission 43 veterans and the adaptive population. I mean, they just work so well together. Veterans love to volunteer at all their events. Veterans were also part of them. I mean, there's just a really symbiotic relationship between those two. And it just kind of kept growing and growing and growing. And we're like, you know what? These guys need their own space. They need somewhere that they can impact more lives and do more. And that's when we started saying, you know, it'd be really cool. Idaho is so special. Obviously, Idaho is a big focus in everything that we do. But what makes Idaho unique is all the outdoor recreation. We have hiking, fishing, skiing, mountain biking, kayaking, surfing, you know, with the play waves and everything. We're like, how can we make an Idaho-focused field house that can get these people, that can train these people up, can get them the equipment they need to go out and experience Idaho? Whether it's you've got one leg or no legs and you want to go mountain biking, or you want to go kayaking, you want to go surfing, you want to do any of these things that are so unique to Idaho. And we started, you know, brainstorming. We started working with architects, and we dreamed up the Idaho, which I'm wearing, the Idaho Outdoor Field House, which we just cut the ribbon on Veterans Day, so about a month ago. And it's an incredible facility. I mean, from the training room, the gym, the training room looks like it's, you know, an SEC school football's training room. I mean, it's the state-of-the-art training room, and it's all built for people that have some type of physical challenge so that they can go in there and they can train to go and do these sports, right? Whether they want to go and play on the Special Olympic field hockey team or the ice hockey team or do a triathlon or whatever, these people can go there, they can train. We have an equipment room. They can get, you know, the equipment in all of these sports is so specialized. You can't just have a adaptive chair for something come off the line, because it needs to be kind of specially fit for each of these people especially when they're competing at a high level. And so we have a room that can do that can make adjustments. We have a 3D printer that can like print these parts so we can like help people and adapt to certain things. We've got a full, what's a like an Olympic size pool? Is it 20 meters, 40, 50? I don't know, 25 meters. We got a full like Olympic size pool that has a ninja course on it. And it's got a walk-in ramp, so you could literally ride a wheelchair right into the pool, and then you could be swimming instead of having to get one of those cherry picker things that puts you in. We got a rock climbing wall. We've got an indoor gym, basketball, everything. We've got a full HBOT facility, which you've been very involved with. You know, yeah. Hyperbaric oxygen treatment, and you can probably do a better job of explaining what that
well,
does.
Well, I think it's
some of the success that we've had with that.
I think it's one of the stories. So your dad calls, and he's like, hey, can you come down and talk to me about something? And I go down, he's like, hey, I'm a big, he had data. Like, your dad's a data guy, right? And he says, I've got data that shows we've been diving some of these veterans for PTSD, and it is very effective, but no one pays for it. So he'd been paying for it out of the foundation on his own, quietly, and literally saving people's lives. I mean, you would talk to these veterans who had gone through the hyperbaric treatment for PTSD, and they were different people out the other end. And he's like, damn it, we're gonna figure this out. And so I start doing some research, and we start asking around the country, well, it's very well known that this works for people, but no one has taken the initiative to do what your dad's doing here in Boise, Idaho. And so this new campus has a hyperbarics facility that, and I will never forget, because early on I said, hey, Joe, like, when we do this, we probably ought to figure out a way to make it so that it's profitable and you can bring other people in. And you know, I'm just like thinking from a pro forma, like, we got to make this profitable. And he looks at me, he's like, don't bring that up again. He's like, we're doing this for them. And once we take care of them, then we'll worry about that. And I like, it's so unusual, Brian. And I just, you get to be around it all the time, but to have someone that is so dedicated and determined to help people, he knew it was the right thing to do. Now there's going to be, when I say world-class, there won't be anything like this in the world. here in Boise with his hyperbaric facility right next to the field house. I just think it is under the radar, but it's world class. It's leading the world in things that are helping people that need it most. I'll never forget. So it's up and running, and we'll be opening stores very soon.
It's not quite up and running yet. Our goal is to have our first group in there, I think, in the spring, March or April.
Yeah.
I think we'll start doing our first dives. When you go and you have a hyperbaric oxygen treatment, it's called a dive because you breathe 100% oxygen under pressure. So it's kind of like pressurizing, like you're going in a submarine or something. But it's going to be really neat. And I'm really excited to see how that's going to impact people's lives. I think that the research and the medical community has only scratched the surface on some of the possibilities with it. And it's off label. They won't use it, even though it's proven to help PTSD and any type of TBI or any brain injury, depression, anxiety. They won't use it for any of that. Hospitals will have it, and they use it for wound healing. And that's the only thing that they use it for.
And our goal, and now that I've talked to enough national people, I think this facility will actually drive to where insurance companies will need to pay. That will be the future, and it will go back to your family saying, hey, we're going to do this. One more thing on that. I love the fact that Dan is a former, you know, you listen to his life and how it changed, and now he's part of the team to do it. So I love how you integrate veterans into everything you do and create so much purpose. And then they're the best advocates because they've been through it. So it's really, really cool. I do want to talk a little bit more about community. We're going to probably, I don't know when they're going to release this one, but talk a little bit about Idaho and the community. We could never, and you wouldn't want us to do this, but for the 20 years here that I've been in the business world, it has been your family's foundation that oftentimes secretly, very, very quietly goes around, and your fingerprints are literally all over the valley. A lot of times it's where it's most needed. It's safety net organizations. It's everywhere. And talk to me a little bit about how important that legacy is for you and your family to the people of Idaho and that connection.
It's very important, and we get a lot of joy doing it. Like I said, we spent a lot of time and a lot of money and effort in changing education in Idaho for a long time, and we didn't make much progress. I think that we've made a tremendous amount of progress in the last 10 years because we started a charter school initiative, and that's where we've made the biggest wave and impact in education in Idaho. So we feel a lot better about how we've done to improve education in that avenue, and it took us a long time to get there. But where we find the most joy is definitely in providing different types of recreational opportunities for people in Idaho, also in supporting organizations that we believe very heavily in. And Idaho is it's changing. It's changing a lot, and it's changing fast. There's a lot of people that want to come to Idaho. I like to think it's because of some of the things that our foundation has done to make Idaho such a special place. And we haven't really changed Idaho. I think we've just tried to amplify Idaho. We've taken everything that's so great about Idaho and just tried to make it better and more accessible.
Fantastic. Want to talk a little bit about, because you hit on it a little bit, but tell me a couple lessons you've learned from your dad.
I think a lot of it is his humility. That his humility, his dedication to family, and his just kind of nose to the grindstone. I think it's becoming more and more of a lost art for people to not have to feel like they have to celebrate themselves. You get a lot of egos, especially if you've been successful, especially as you get later in life and feel like you've accomplished a lot. You know, people's egos tend to grow and they get in the way. And probably the biggest thing and something I really strive for is to keep my ego in check, to try to stay humble, you know, to try to do things in the shadows and, just look back and smile and not have to find joy by people recognize me for doing something, just for doing something and then just watching it make an impact in other people's lives.
Want to talk a little bit about your family. Tell us about how important it is for you to be a father and what you've learned from your father and how important it is for that legacy to be Because I know you're a lot of things, but at the top of that list, you're a father.
Yeah, you know, I think being a father is most people's favorite job. It's definitely mine, and everybody brags about their family. I love my family. I'm very, very blessed. I've got an amazing wife. I've got an unbelievable daughter. I've got a really cool son, and have a lot of fun. I mean, that's 100% why I quit racing. I felt like if I was doing the race car thing, I was a race car driver first and I was a father second. And I was like, that order of things is backwards. I should be a father first and foremost. And when you're racing, your whole family is doing everything for you. I mean, we're traveling, we're doing everything to pursue my dream and my passion. And there's nothing wrong with that. But in my mind, I was missing Idaho. I love Idaho. I love hunting and fishing and being outdoors. And when I grew up, that was some of my favorite memories with my dad, is he took me hunting and fishing and exploring the mountains and doing everything, that snowmobiling, riding motorcycles and doing this. And then when my son was born and we had two, I was raising him by traveling every weekend and living in a motorhome. And I'm like, no, I need to raise him like I was raised, like my dad raised me, in the mountains and doing things that are so cool and special about Idaho. So that's why I pulled the chute on the whole racing career and came here to try to provide my kids with the same experience I had, the same things that my dad took me to do. I now try to do the same things with my kids. I take them bird hunting and I take them skiing and I take them fishing and I take them to ride motorcycles. And, you know, we have so much fun doing that. And that's all, you know, part of my dad's legacy is just how he was a father to me and how I'm trying to be that same type of father in a lot of ways to my family.
Yeah, I do. And the more I get to know your dad and the legacy, it is family. It is deeply family first, and then it's taking care of community. It really is, and it's a great example for all of us. We have a lot of business minded folks that listen to this, kind of winding down here. But if you had to list your top three or four things you think are most important for a business leader, leadership training. I get a lot of emails from younger folks that listen to this. What do you think you would be focusing on if you were a young leader trying to grow a company or trying to really break into the business world?
Oh, that's a great question. I pull a lot from my racing days. Was around some really talented leaders, great leaders. And I think, you know, first and foremost, anybody that's successful, they're successful because of the people they surround themselves with. They're not successful because they are super smart. Maybe you might have somebody like an Elon Musk that might be the exception to the rule, right? But you're typically successful because of the people you surround yourself with and how you lead them and make them feel about the job that they're doing. I would say the trait of good leaders, one of the most important traits of the good leaders, is you take none of the credit when things are going good and you take all of the blame when things are going bad. It's a large part you're successful because of your team, and a large part you fail because of yourself, because of the leader or the person that's, you know, driving the ship. So you gotta figure out how to fall on the sword, but do it in a way that energizes the team and makes them not hate you for being a failure or because a project didn't work. And, you know, how do you take that? Like in racing, if something happened on the racetrack, if we had a bad pit stop, you know, I didn't start my career like this. I started my career very much coming on the radio and flying off the handlebars and trying to chew everybody's ass that, you know, they made a mad, they dropped the tire, they didn't change the tire correctly, we didn't get it full of gas, we lost spots on pit road, and that was all their fault, and then, damn it, you guys, be better, and we can't have these type of mistakes. And at the end of my career, you know, I would try to take that same scenario, we lost spots on pit road, and I'd try to come on the radio and try to be the leader and say, hey, it's all right, guys, you know, like, it's all good, I'll get the spots back, and I know that you guys are gonna do better in the next time. And you take that about anything in business, you know, you got to try to apply that same principle. If you have something going bad, some leaders will chew their team out, you know, and there might be a time and a place very rarely to do that. But typically it's, hey, we're in this together. All right, let's figure out how to get back from that. And then let's figure out how to go forward.
Wow, that's fantastic. Words of wisdom. Hey, well, I want you to know how much we appreciate you and the community, your family, for all you do, the example you set. It really never stops. Thanks for all you do for the Youth Ranch. you know, you're a big supporter there. Mission 43, the way you lead, the way you guide, and thanks for coming on today.
I appreciate it, Tom.
Thanks.